All right, welcome. Again, I didn't do a very long intro to myself earlier. For those who don't know me, my name is Mike Hamilton. Been in the industry longer than I care to admit. Also one of the core team, one of the founders here at Madcap Software. So that's the short version. We're going to be covering micro content today, but this is going to be much more of a high-level overview just to make sure that everybody's kind of talking the same language. Why have we added this functionality to Flare? What is our vision as to what it means today? What is our vision as to what micro content is going to mean tomorrow? Why have we even added this functionality? So that's kind of one aspect of the presentation. And then another aspect is just what is micro content? I always like starting with definitions. So the agenda, we'll start with a definition, just what is micro content? What are the attributes? How can you recognize micro content? Then we'll talk about a micro content strategy. One of the things that we've kind of been guilty of as a company, we're very good at putting tools in your hand that have great buttons to push, but we never tell you why to push those buttons. So a little bit of strategy, okay, what's kind of a best practice if you're going to go down the path of doing micro content? And then I'll get my crystal ball out and we'll look off into the future a bit. Where do we see micro content going? And I think that's what's kind of unique about micro content. It was kind of mentioned earlier, Paul said there's kind of major milestones we remember. I think this is going to be a milestone in that when you add a new feature in a tool like Flare, it's usually kind of a milestone for that one release. And then it kind of gets forgotten a little bit. What's different about this is if you use Flare 2019 today, you can immediately get the benefits of micro content. But we've barely scratched the surface of what can be done with it. So this is kind of one of those new features that you'll probably see expanding and growing over time. And that'll make more sense as we get more into the slides. All right, so that's the agenda that I have planned. So what is micro space content or micro hyphen content or micro camel case content? When you start doing research on this subject, you will find that it's just everybody kind of does their own thing. And you're going to find that's kind of a theme in this presentation, and that's one of the tricky bits. Saying we're going to do micro content, be careful of that statement. It can be taken a bunch of different ways, but we'll dig into that. All right, so wanting to start with a definition, I jumped up where you typically go for a first definition, good old Wikipedia. And of course, Wikipedia, like a lot of resources out there, they actually credit Jacob Nielsen as being the first person to kind of put their thumb on this thing that we call micro content. Now, it goes all the way back to 1998. That's a long time ago. Why are we just talking about it now? Well, Jacob Nielsen is credited with describing it for the first time, not inventing it. And what Jacob Nielsen basically described is he said that micro content as a concept, it refers to short content such as headlines, summaries, which need to be immediately clear and inviting to a reader. And here's the really important bit, which still makes sense when removed from their original context. Now, what's amazing, that's not a half-bad definition, even though it's more than 20 years old. I mean, Jacob had a pretty good crystal ball there. Now, he got quite a bit of it wrong by today's standards, but as far as like a first attempt, that was pretty good. But again, I put italics described because the more you dig into this, you kind of say, well, wait a minute. Before 1998, people were doing things like this. This wasn't a new thing. Because if you dig back in time, oh, and of course the obligatory Jacob Nielsen quote, micro-content should be an ultra-short abstract of its associated macro-content. All right, had to give Jacob his due there. But like I said, however, is it a new thing? You can go all the way back to like SGML systems, systems that were in use, you know, even in the 80s. And we were already using techniques to reuse content fragments. It just hadn't been formalized. And all of these systems that were using these content fragments, it was very siloed. It was only a reuse case internally in a very closed ecosystem. So content reuse was happening even at the fragment level, but Jacob really kind of spotted it as a trend and put a name on it. So that's kind of where the term comes from. All right, so enough of the 1990s. Let's move into the new millennium. If you're familiar with Anil Dash, he's a technology blogger. He put a definition on microcontent in 2002. And I'm going to poke a little fun at Mr. Dash here, because he's describing microcontent in the most macro way I have ever seen. This long wandering, today, microcontent is being used as a more general term. And okay, let's microcontent Mr. Dash's information here. What if you distill what he came up with down to its core essence, is Mr. Dash says that microcontent conveys a single concept. It's easily accessible via link. Okay, that's now kind of an amendment to what Jacob Nielsen said. And it's written for any reuse possibility. That's kind of an important aspect. It's content agnostic. According to Mr. Dash, microcontent can be used just as easily on a computer screen, as a tablet, as on a display on a refrigerator, as being spoken by Alexa. It's just content agnostic. All right, so we're evolving. We're getting to a better definition now. So let's get into the 2010s. Mr. Buzzworth came up with the definition. And this is well documented online. Essentially, microcontent is as it sounds. Okay, I'm already getting warning bells. We're in the technical writing industry. When you say it's as it sounds, that's not a definition. Typically low-cost, high-value content. All right, put the brakes on. We're getting into buzzword bingo here. And he goes on to say, well, it's social media content. Put the brakes on. This is one of the big problems you're going to run into. If you are in a meeting, a project planning meeting back at the office, and somebody at the table, be it a project manager, a vice president, whoever it is, they come up with, you know, we should really do some of this micro content. What's going to happen is 10 other heads at the table are all going to nod, oh, yes, yes, we should do micro content. Stop that discussion in its tracks. Because as we've just seen, this is a term that means very different things to very different people. It all depends on their perspective. Mr. Buzzworth is in digital marketing. So to him, microcontent is social media. So if you're going to agree, yes, we're going to do this thing, we'll make sure everybody agrees on exactly what that thing is going to be, how it will be created, how it will be distributed, how will customers consume it. So that's kind of a big caution that I found as we've been researching for the last couple of years developing this functionality, which kind of lends itself to a joke. a marketing manager, a web manager, an application developer, and a technical writer walk into a bar. No, just kidding. Again, the whole thing is don't rely on buzzwords. If someone decides we're going to do this, okay, how do you envision that? What does that look like to you? What does that mean to you? I'm not going to agree to do it until I know the details. Also, one of the things, and actually let me back up a little bit, to kind of wrap this up, what I found is it was very difficult to find a single valid definition of micro-content. So I switched gears a little bit. If I can't come up with a single good definition, well, what are its attributes? How can we recognize it if we see it? Which is kind of a chicken way of coming at a definition from the back door. So another neat thing about micro-content that I haven't seen in any of these other definitions, and it's one of the things that struck us at MadCap, is that even those older systems that were using fragments, it was always in a closed silo. One of the things that's really letting micro-content take off is its public nature. And that's where I think Mr. Dash hit it pretty good. He talked about it was content publicly accessible via a link. So publicly available micro-content is the kind of content that is used by Google, Alexa, Bixby, smartwatches, Internet of Things devices. This is information that any device connected to the internet can literally extract data from. So that's becoming kind of a common component in a lot of micro-content. On the other hand, there is private micro-content as well. Earlier in the opening session, you heard people talk about chatbots, automated response systems. Now, when I say private, that doesn't necessarily mean hidden behind a firewall. It just means it's optimized for my query response system, whatever that looks like. So there's some micro-content that is intended to just be publicly consumed by something like Google. There is other micro-content that is, okay, I have a chatbot. If somebody else sees my queries and responses, I don't really care, but it's not going to mean anything to them without the AI we've built into our system to provide the right results. So again, I hope you're seeing a trend. When somebody says, hey, let's do micro-content, okay, which meaning are they talking about? Don't commit to it until they specify. And then one more concept before a definition. And I'm an adult educator going way back. I like to show with examples. So I've got my buddy Joe. Joe is about to leave for work. Does Joe need to take his jacket? Simple question. Well, what that is an example of one of the hundreds of decisions everybody has to make every day. And it's these kinds of decisions that micro-content can solve. And in fact, there's even a name for it. It's called a micro-moment. So that's kind of another trend that I saw as we did all of our research. You can really recognize micro-content because it solves a micro-moment. Now, that could be a micro-moment like Joe here. Do I need my jacket? It could be I'm in your chatbot system. What operating system do you support? That's my micro-moment. I need to know what operating system is supported. Your micro-content comes back and says, oh, it works on this OS or these versions of OS. So you'll always find kind of this relationship. Is there a micro-moment? What micro-content solves that micro-moment? All right, so back to my buddy Joe. Traditionally, do I need a jacket? How does Joe solve that? Well, Joe walks down the hallway, goes into his home office, boots his computer. There's 5 or 6 minutes. Once the computer's up, he launches a web browser. Web browser comes up. He types in a URL. I want to go to theweatherchannel.com. Page loads. Oh, I got to go to my city. He searches on a city. This could be a 10-minute affair just to figure out, do I need to take my jacket today? Well, that's the kind of thing micro-content can fix. Instead of doing all that, all Joe does is take out his smartphone. And on his smartphone screen, there's a little widget that tells him the temperature, kind of the forecast, it's sunny today. And just at a glance, he has solved his micro moment with micro content. So that's really all micro content is. But the key thing isn't so much the content itself, it was the delivery mechanism. Did Joe have to go boot a computer? Did Joe have to go out of his way and bring up a browser? Somebody has already fed him the micro content that he needs. Now, I'm going to hit this a few more times throughout the presentation. In fact, how are we doing on time? I tend to get long-winded here. Nobody wrote that micro content specifically for Joe. Nobody wrote that micro content specifically for that phone. And that's another thing that I'm seeing. A lot of people are like, oh, no, we're not going to do micro content. We can't write the stuff we already have. We're going to write. The whole idea is you shouldn't be writing anything new. That micro content right there on that phone is being pulled from existing sources. Nobody has written anything new. That data, just from doing the research, is actually coming from the Weather Channel website. But when they built the Weather Channel website, they've added extra metadata that says, here's the temperature field. Here's the icon for if it's going to be sunny or cloudy or rainy today. And so all somebody on this phone did is they wrote a little widget, a little mini app, that says, go to the Weather Channel website, grab these 2 or 3 pieces of micro content, and display them here. So, A, it's not anything new. The content already exists. The only new bits are the metadata, how it's scraped and presented. So that is how existing content can become micro content and be delivered to solve a micro moment. Everybody's good? Everybody's like, oh, I was expecting something more than that. It's actually powerful. It's just way simpler than buzzword bingo makes it sound. All right, so, and again, here's what that Weather Channel page actually looks like if you launch it in your web browser. And to be fair, this gives you the long-range forecast. What's it going to be like on Friday versus today? Microcontent doesn't do that. Microcontent is, here's what it is right now, this moment. So it's providing an immediate need, whereas the web page is providing a much more long-term view. So I'm kind of giving away my thunder here, but basically micro-content is just a synopsis of longer form existing information. It's not recreating the wheel. All right, so key aspects of micro-content. And again, I kind of treat public versus private a little bit differently. Public means I expect this to be scavenged by smartphones, by Google, by other scanning devices. Very specific, very targeted information sourced from a deeper resource. We want to avoid writing this as a dedicated silo if we can keep from doing it. Likely to solve a micro moment and critical delivery adaptable. It can work in print, it can work on a screen, it can work on a voice device, it can work any way that information can be delivered or communicated. And the key thing here, available to outside systems. And that's the part where I think what we're doing in Flare today, oh, it's way cool. But there's so much more we can do in the future as other devices learn to extract micro content that we've tagged on our core pages. I'm not going to go there. All right. Now, private micro content. And again, I don't mean hidden behind a firewall. I just mean it's not intended for external tools like Google, but there are still reasons you want to create your own micro content. Chatbots, autoresponders, very targeted information. Again, the goal is to solve a micro moment. Now, to give you an example of that, at Madcap, we aren't currently using chatbots. Since we're adding this functionality, who knows, that may change. But imagine you have a customer that provides the query, what operating system do you support? I don't want to create a whole new answer for a whole new system, but what I could do, I could go to my existing documentation, find the existing page that says, here's our system requirements, go down to the paragraph that talks about operating systems, and literally tag that. This is micro content. Type, operating system. So now an external chatbot or whatever knows if somebody asks or queries, hey, what operating system? It scans thousands of pages, you know, finds the micro content. Oh, operating system, here's the answer. So we're taking existing long-form content and simply adding some additional metadata so that other systems can leverage that content to solve micro moments. Now, the private systems usually require some logic. At the bare minimum, that's usually a query response type of situation. You set the system up so if customer asks X, respond Y. It can be a little bit stilted. There are some more advanced chatbots or AI systems where you can actually do kind of a decision tree or almost like a flow chart. So depending on how customer answers question one, you can actually change the response for question two. It can get a little deeper. But again, once you start getting into the private side, it usually requires some developer effort on the logic side. All right. So that was a big, long, basic discussion of just what is micro content, this crazy thing you keep hearing about, but nobody seems to be able to put their finger on. And hopefully that helped with kind of the attributes side. You should be able to recognize it when you see it now. But now we come to the strategy side. And I will admit, this is where my learning curve, I had to do some work. 3 years ago, as we embarked on this path, I was one of those people that thought this was going to be a whole new silo of content that we had to manage. And that's the worst thing that can be done. So the key to a micro content strategy, and this is going to sound like I'm an old, you know, teacher at university, but a lot of it comes down to the better your content, the higher quality standard your content is written to, the easier it is to use it as micro content. So jumping to fancy code, if you have bad initial content, doesn't really help anything. And I'm trying not to be too when I say bad content, I don't mean it's like grammatically horrible or anything like that. But there are some authors who have gotten into some techniques which can really get in the way of micro content. I'm sure we've all read, you know, technical documentation where they've tried to be a little jokesterish in the headings. They've tried to be cute. They've tried to be funny. That might be great for a silo document, but that's a technique that can kill that heading for micro content reuse purposes. So when I say bad content, I don't necessarily mean poorly written. It's just not written well in regards to a reuse strategy. Did that make sense? I hope. All right, so the key to micro content is start with the fundamentals. Write good content with an eye to reuse. And that means your headings should truly be a summary of what's on this page. Your subheadings need to be a true summary of this subsection of this page. And if it's not, it's time to do some edits. It's also an easier transition, and this is like Anthony mentioned earlier in the keynote, if you've already made the transition to topic-based authoring, then just the mental model of micro-content is easier to adapt to. And just to use a very horrible graphic, because I am not a graphic artist, you know, 3 decades ago, we focused on writing giant documents. And then fast forward a few decades, and we started writing more at the chapter level. And then chapters could be recycled and reused. And then we moved on to sections or even topics, getting into content management. And then entire procedures could be reused. And then cool tools like Flare and a few others, you know, a few years ago came down to things like snippets. Even little phrases can be reused. But snippets were that internal model. Yeah, there's reuse, but only within Flare. And now we're evolving into that micro-content model. It's kind of the next logical step. And all it really means is where snippets, we put metadata around it for use in Flare. Micro-content means we put metadata around it and keep the metadata there when we publish. Other systems can now recognize that metadata. All right, and kind of repeating what I said earlier, one of the keys is just starting with well-authored content. Proper headings, proper subheadings, concise writing. Something as simple as I have this giant procedure. The heading one might be the title of the procedure, but is the very first paragraph a proper summary of the procedure? If the answer is no, you're going to have a hard time doing micro-content because I want to be able to extract that top-level summary if I need to. So I'm going to show a couple of different techniques here, and I will be, this is kind of full disclosure, some of this comes from research. Not all of this is stuff we can do in Flare today. I'll show you which bits we focus on versus just things I've seen in industry. Now, one strategy is if you're doing a very deep procedural document, make sure that every procedural step, no matter how in-depth it gets, its very first sentence is a summary or an overview of the entire step. You might think, well, duh. It's amazing how many procedures out there don't. To give you an example, there's actually an article out there on WikiHow, how to tie your shoes. And if I pull up that web page on WikiHow, let's see if we can stress test our internet connection here. It is not a short article because it doesn't just tell you how to tie your shoes. I'm sure you can't read it from where you are, but it basically says, oh, you want to tie shoes? Well, there are 4 primary methods for doing that. The first method, the beginner knot, it goes through all this information. There are big digital photographs. If we scroll down, there's this giant step 1, including bullets. Step 2... Now, step 3, it's actually loading a video. Which lace goes over which other lace, yada, yada. So this is pretty. And then we get down to method 2, the bunny ears technique. I mean, this is long-form content if there ever was. But if we look closer, every step starts with this bold text. Tie another knot, but don't tighten it. That's a summary for the entire step. Now, why did they carefully craft it that way? Well, because when our friends Google scan that page, they recognize the underlying metadata. So what is a long form page, if you do the Google search, at the top, now I cut it off, but down below, there's a couple of hundred search results. But what shows up at the very top of the search results now? Here are the 6 steps to tie your shoes. That information is coming from that big long form article we just looked at. But Google has an algorithm that automatically grabs those first summary sentences from every step and automatically posts that at the top of the search results. For a lot of people, they don't even have to click a link now. Just doing the Google search gave them what they needed. Or to go back 5 slides, that just solved their micro moment. And it solved it with micro content that was literally scraped from that WikiHow page. So that's kind of a real life use case. Now, one of the things that I also learned in doing my research, you might think that the WikiHow article got this little snippet at the top of the search results because it was the number one search result. Nope. It turns out Google actually uses 2 different algorithms now. One algorithm decides what the search ranking of a page should be, but they then have a second algorithm to extract this micro content. The second algorithm looks through the top 10 results, figures out, okay, which one has the best micro content. That gets pulled and becomes the featured snippet at the top of the search page. So that WikiHow article, if you were to look down, it's actually search result number 7. It almost dropped out of the top 10, but they had the best micro content, so they won that coveted micro content slot. All right, so that's an example of micro content in a real world scenario. So, and again, just to summarize, each of those little micro-content summary sentences from each step, Google extracted automatically and produced this little mini procedure. So each step written long form that just summarizes what I said. Beginning of each step is a summary of that step. No content duplication. Again, I'm beating that horse. They didn't write something special for Google to use. This just came directly out of their official long-form procedure. All right, so a second strategy. Now, that is one you can do in your FLAIR topics if you're trying to feed a public site and you want Google to pick things up. Our search doesn't quite go to that level yet, but this we can do today, what I'm about to show you. So a second strategy, start the topic or article with that summary paragraph. Again, another technique. Then inside the FLAIR editor, you simply identify that summary paragraph as the micro content for this subject. That will work internally. That will also work with Google. Now, an example of this, I used Wikipedia. And I just picked a topic that was relatively long, but kind of obscure, nuclear physics. So if I pull up the nuclear physics Wikipedia article, it just rambles on and on and on about nuclear physics. But what if I go to Google and I search nuclear physics? Well, guess what? This first summary paragraph has been marked as the micro content. So what happens? Well, that's the full Wikipedia article, but when you search in Google, all your search results are down here, but then the official featured snippet, they call it, they just lifted that first paragraph out of the Wikipedia article. With FLAIR 2019, you can do that today. both with our internal search and with Elasticsearch. Now, we can put the micro content metadata in there for Google as well, but that's a trickier bit. Your page has to rank in the top 10 search results first before the Google secondary algorithm will even then inspect for the proper micro content. But we can set you up to make that spot. So it's like magic. Yeah, we wish. There's basically kind of three different methods in the industry for doing the metadata portion, because that's really kind of what triggers this whole process. So you as an author, you have to identify the parts of your topic that you feel constitute the micro content. What are the bits that would solve a micro moment? And it's not hard. If you've ever been in Flare, how many people have been in Flare and created a snippet? Just about everybody in the room. Guess what? You already know how to create micro content. In Flare 2019, when you highlight text and right-click, there's that option, create snippet. There's now an option, create micro content. You already know the technique. So the challenge is, though, we've taken kind of the most common denominator approach, but in industry, there's actually three different techniques. Now, for open systems, publicly scannable, Google scannable, Alexa scannable type systems, that would be microdata, microformats, and an actual microdata format called RDFA. Now, normally I go through all three of these. Since this is the Mad World audience, I'll give you the punchline. Microformats is what Flare uses. It's probably the most commonly used technique for identifying microdata or microcontent, but there are these other two techniques in existence. There is no real winner right now. It's kind of the early days of microcontent. So to describe what these different techniques require, what microdata is when you actually add what might technically be extra illegal markup to your core topics. But you make it legal by linking to an external set of rules. Now, the most common is a site called schema.org. Schema.org gets pretty deep. They actually list hundreds of new bits of metadata. If you're describing a novel, then they have special metadata codes for cover art, chapter, or a book title, publisher. If you're documenting a web page, they have a whole extra set of metadata. So it's kind of broken into categories even. But the key thing is you have to take your content page, link it to schema.org, which then augments your HTML5 properties with additional legal properties, the additional metadata that you can use. Some people like that. It's very specific. It's very controlled. Some people don't like that because it's going above and beyond that core W3C specification of HTML5. But that does work. Now, I'm not going to get like super deep codey. If you want super deep codey, come to my workshop on Wednesday. But as a quick overview, if I have a page and, you know, my body's way up top, and I have this image that's the cover of my book I'm trying to sell, and there's my book cover JPEG, and then it's just inside of a paragraph, I have the title of my book. Well, outside tools can't find any of that. But if in the body I link to schema.org, and I use their webpage rules, and I also link to schema.org, and I use their book rules, Well, now I can give it an item property of image. That means that's a book cover. Item property of name. That's the book name. And so any tool that understands these extra bits of metadata can now extract the key bits from my web page. So theoretically, somebody else who's putting together a library of books on a genre without even telling me could scrape the data for my book and post it on their site, basically with my permission because I've made this metadata public. So that's the kind of things that can be done. Now, that's one technique. Now, micro formats, this is what we do. And if you go back to that WikiHow article on tying tennis shoes, that's the technique that they use. We're still going to add the extra metadata, but we're going to do it within the rules of HTML5. So here, they've added this div, class equals summary, and they've wrapped it around the heading one and that summary paragraph. So we're still saying this is the summary, but we're using a div with a class property versus just creating a whole bunch of new rules and extra metadata. Is one better than the other? Well, since we're doing it this way, of course I'm going to say this way is better. But officially in the industry, there are people using both techniques. And then finally, RDFA, that is short for the Resource Description Framework. That is actually a form of microdata. It's where my page references another rules page so I can add more stuff. Well, didn't I cover that already? Well, this one gets a special mention because RDFA is actually a W3C recommendation. This was written by the World Wide Web Consortium. It was actually published many years ago, but nobody seems to use it. So it's similar to how schema.org worked, but it just has not gained popularity. You'll find a handful of sites that use it. It works. It is valid. But my understanding is Google doesn't even read for it. Google looks for the first two techniques when they're looking for their preferred snippets. All right, so that was all public stuff. Now, when we get to private use, things like chatbots, autoresponders, things like that, that becomes a real sticky wicket. The problem is there are over a dozen different chatbots that you can either purchase or are available open source, and there is no common syntax or language between them. They all do their own thing. So as a result, one of the older ones, there's a chatbot named Alice. It's kind of famous. It was one of the first ones. I believe it's open source these days. But if you want to use the Alice chatbot, which you don't, it's way out of date by now, but you have to author all of your content in this proprietary one-of markup language called AIML, the Artificial Intelligence Markup Language. But how many chatbots use that? One, Alice. None of the others do. They all have kind of rolled their own proprietary language. So chatbots or autoresponder AI systems, that becomes a whole tougher wicket to crack. So what we have done to try and get Flare ready for that future is we've chosen, okay, what's the least common denominator? So we do this as question-response pairs or even logic trees, but the queries are all written in a single plain vanilla XML file, and then the responses to those queries are in plain vanilla HTML5 files. Now, the reason we did it that way, there are some chatbots that will use HTML5 response files. So it would be very easy for your developers to transform our query XML file to whatever their query syntax is required to be. Or it's trivially easy to transform HTML5 files as well. So that's kind of the state of affairs in Flare 2019. The adding of the microcontent metadata we support today. And it will even work in our searches and external searches. Getting into the chatbot world, it still requires a lot of coordination with developers, but we've created a system where actual writers can write content, or better yet, you can go to your long-form content, highlight a bit of text, and say, this is micro-content. Flare will then pop up and say, well, what's the query? What's the problem that solves? This is what operating system to use. And then, boom, we create that question, that query-answer pair for you in these generic formats. And that can just be handed off to your developers for them to consume. And that's a quick snapshot of the editor. I'm sure you'll be seeing it more. If you go to Paul's session, you'll definitely get tired of this if you come to my workshop on Wednesday. But that's an example. Those are all of the queries that somebody, if we're there to ask a question, okay, what's the corresponding content, the micro-content, that should be returned to them? And without going too deep, we've got 4 minutes left. Some of these line items, I could literally just type them into this interface, or, like this one that's linked, that's actually coming from content that exists in a topic already. I just right-clicked and said, make this part of the micro-content system. So, not too deep on that. All right, the future. This is what really excites me. I think what I've shown you today and what Paul's going to show you and what I can do in the workshop on Wednesday is just the tip of the iceberg. Everybody's all hung up on chatbots and auto. I think it's the Alexas, the Googles. I think that's where the true power comes in. So I'm going to do a little make-believe what-if scenario, and we'll see who here is like an Uber nerd. Does anybody recognize that screenshot? About five people. All right, you guys are in the Uber nerd club. That is a screen grab of one of the very first webcams that ever existed in the world. It was a student at Cambridge University who got tired of going all the way downstairs to the break room just to find out the coffee pot was empty. So they, before anybody else figured out a way to do it, pointed a camera at the coffee pot. It only refreshed like 2 frames a second. It was really horrible. But this way, from their desktop, they could launch an app and see if the coffee pot was empty and not waste the trip downstairs. That took a lot of work, though, because this was done longhand. First, they had to invent this idea of a webcam. They had to write all the code to make it work. They had to have a computer. They had to have addresses. They had to launch applications. Well, what if back then they had micro-content? What if we just wrote a little script that analyzed that image and it came back with either green, yellow, or red? Green means plenty of coffee. Yellow means you better hurry. Red means don't waste the trip. There's no coffee left. If our script could convert those into just a little micro-content string, then all they would have to do would be look at their phone and decide, should I make the trip for coffee or not? So that's where I see the future of micro-content is the Internet of Things. What data can solve micro-moments on any device that's sitting in front of us? All right, so summary. We looked at definitions. We looked at attributes. I talked about strategy. It really hinges on having really well-authored content in the first place. And as far as the future, again, if you think about solving micro-moments, then you're thinking micro-content. All right, I think we have 10 seconds for a question, if anybody wants to grab the microphone in the middle of the room. Everybody's good? All right, save all your questions for poor Paul then at his session. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your Mad World.